I'm Glenn Gass, and welcome to WFIU's Profiles, a weekly program that introduces members of our community, as well as notable visiting artists, scholars, and entertainers to the WFIU audience. Our guest today is Todd Rundgren. Happy to say, Todd Rundgren, a legendary rocker known for his own hits, as well as his productions for others, as well as his band Utopia, and as well as being a still vital artist 4 decades into a remarkable career. And for those of you that might welcome a little refresher course, I should add that Todd is here at Indiana University in his new capacity as Wells Scholars Professor. So here is a bit of Professor Rundgren through the years. Welcome, Todd.
Thank you very much. Well, at least you got one rocker in there at the end. You announce me as a rocker and then play all of the ballads.
Well, I like the ballads. I'm sorry. But actually, that's a good first question. Before those songs fade too far from the listener's mind, what's it like for an artist like you, so vital, creative, expansive, to have your career reduced to a collage like that or a greatest hits album? Does it?
It's good to be in a position to be reduced, I suppose. A lot of careers turn out to be anecdotal because they're brilliant but brief. And as you mentioned, I'm in my 5th decade of making music for what at this particular point in time is a fairly loyal and long-suffering audience. And I've always felt that the best revenge from a musician standpoint is to outlast everybody. And from my lofty perch at this point in my career, I tend to look at the people who have managed to make the full journey, like Tony Bennett and B.B. King and people like that. And those, I guess, are nowadays more the kinds of musicians that I identify with than with the sort of young band traveling around in a van from little club to a little club, which is kind of where I started out from.
So it doesn't bug you when the man on the street knows. Actually, the man on the street probably doesn't know who did Bang on the Drum. You've referred to that as Happy Birthday, a song everybody knows, but nobody really stops to think, gee, I wonder who did that.
Yeah, it's one thing to have hit records. It's another thing to create something that has become completely incorporated into the culture. And I actually find equal satisfaction in that. And I didn't think so at the time when everyone started singing Bang the Drum at sporting events and became a drive-time hit. I didn't think that it was anything more than a curiosity. But as it turns out, in the long run, it actually turned into the occasional payday as well, because its status as a party anthem has piqued the interest of advertisers. And now, for instance, Carnival Cruise Line has maybe for the 3rd year in a row bought the rights to use the song in their commercials.
Mm-hmm.
And so what was for me a musical throwaway has become a financial linchpin a certain way. So.
At what point did you realize that song had taken on a life of its own? Because it wasn't immediate.
It wasn't immediate, and it at first it was a Friday drive time song. I don't think it went directly to the stadium. It went first to local radio, and I guess the sentiment worked for, you know, Friday when you're on your way home for the weekend and kissing your job goodbye. So it, I'm not sure what market it started in either, but it's kind of spread across the country. And this was outside the window of it being released as a single. It never was really released as a single. I think, as I recall correctly, Bearsville didn't really hear much of anything on the record that they felt like releasing. And it did get, I think, a token release, but some time after the album had come out, and it just didn't seem relevant at the time. But years later, literally years later, is when the song started to become popular again. And then
did it morph into a sports celebration?
Who knows about that? You know, it's just maybe some. There may be some sports venues where they still have an organist. It's a great song for an organist to play, I suppose.
And a great song for a crowd to chant. And
yeah, but it seems to have no direct correlation to sports. There's no mention of sports in it, so I don't know how that connection was made. But then again, Gary Glitter's Rock and Roll Part 2, that doesn't even have words in it, so I don't know how that became a sports anthem. It's just one of these things that people find easy to sing along together when they feel festive, I guess.
Well, we had our own moment here at Indiana University for our football game when you led the marching band, directed the band in that song. I think people have this impression that, you know, and it's, I'm sure, mistaken, that one hit, like if you wrote Hang on Sloopy or Green Tambourine, you just live off that the rest of your life and everything's, you've got it made. I'm assuming that's not, it's not as easy as that.
Well, writing the song is only one aspect of the process. There's, of course, the recording of the song, and there is the incorporation of the song into your live performances, which allows you to create yet another sort of product out of it. But a musician's lifestyle is unusual in ways that people probably don't think about. They probably only think about what the upside might be, the attention, the ability to play music, lifestyle, I suppose. But you're in a different position than most people. For instance, you're not working for somebody else. You're working for yourself. So you often find yourself in trouble when tax time comes because there's been no withholding during the rest of the year. And you have to come up with a giant sum of money keep the IRS at bay. And so that's been just a constant fixture in my life. It's like the IRS is my ex-wife or something. And also you are, or at least I am in that certain sense, I'm an employer. I have to pay all the musicians who work for me. I have to bear the expense of travel and equipment costs and things like that. So the money comes in, the money goes out. And you're essentially running a company in a way, and whatever it is that you can make off the music is the operating expenses of the company. So if you don't manage to sort of keep the income at a certain level, your lifestyle is going to overtake you, and you'll have to get another job doing something else.
But it must be remarkable to have a song like that, have this second, third, fourth, hundredth life, end up on a cruise commercial and just keep...
It is remarkable, but the problem is it's something that you have no control over. Yeah. You know, it's, as I say, the song really had a life of its own, and nobody envisioned what was going to happen with it. Otherwise, we might have planned a little bit more for it.
Well, I know Hello, It's Me was a Tums commercial last year, I think.
Yeah, it was a Tums commercial. We always thought that the first application for that would be for like AT&T or something like that. But I don't know, Tums commercial, why not?
Sure. You seem to have kind of a love-hate relationship with that, with your hits, with Hello, It's Me, with Something, Anything, this sense that it was A little too easy, a little too plain to the audience.
Well, I think that's, you know, love, hate, I think I've heard that a few times. I think that's a mischaracterization. It's just that I evolved past that point, you know, and a lot of the times the audience, that's the last thing they want from you is any sign of musical evolution. Once they become attracted to what you do, they want you to just do that. And the problem there for me is that I got into the music business because I was a musician, not because I wanted to be a celebrity or, well, I did want girls to chase me like the Beatles, but that's just natural. I always had musical goals that I wanted to achieve more than commercial high water marks or the kind of celebrity that maybe John Bon Jovi enjoys. And instead looked at my opportunities as being entirely musical. And at a certain point after I had done the aforementioned Something Anything that had 3 or 4 radio hits on it, I made just a purely musical estimation of it. It had nothing to do with how successful it was. And realized that I was not investing myself in the music in a way that I was capable of. And so after that, I took a different approach to songwriting. It was a much less commercial approach. But I was becoming myself instead of the male Carole King. In the long run, I think that that's why I still have a career now. If I had continued to write Something Anything 2, Something Anything 3, whatever, the audience ultimately would have been bored with it, and I would have inevitably come up against a choice about how to evolve. And a lot of artists, they would just evolve into whatever was popular at the time. I recall, like, Rod Stewart going disco. Mm-hmm. It worked for him, certainly worked for him, but it was a dubious kind of...
Well, I've heard you
make career choice in a way.
I've heard you make a distinction several times between an entertainer who has to think about his audience and actually play to their expectations and an artist who has to be true to himself, herself, and their muse, and the audience can come along or not.
Mm-hmm. And, well, you know, different audiences, I think, understand that in different ways. You know, it seems that we always assume to talk about the pop audience that buys or that would have bought records for, in the top 10, top 20, that sort of thing. I have always tried to remind the people that I make records for that, of course, we're trying for commercial success today, but you don't want to be ashamed of your record 5 years from now because all you cared about was its commercial possibilities. And so I've always made records, hopefully, to be able to listen to them like way down the line and still feel like there was something real going on musically and not just a calculation to try and make the record commercially successful.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you wouldn't mind going back to Something Anything for one more time, I'll play you one of my favorite songs and favorite songs of all time, actually, Couldn't I Just Tell You from Something Anything.
That's a little more rock.
Yeah, you were complaining I wasn't playing your rock songs. Now, I don't. Is that a rock song? It's a rock song.
It's a pop song.
It's rock, a folky
pop, power pop.
Power
I don't
pop.
Know, whatever. And that song also has, you know, its own reputation, separate from any other song on on Something Anything, even though it was not released as a single, or if it was, I don't know whatever happened to it. But
it seems a remarkable hybrid of pop, rock, folky sensibilities.
And it is a song that musicians tend to
gravitate
towards, as opposed to the audience at large.
And boyfriends making mixtapes for their girlfriends.
Ah, that
must
kind of
be
thing,
the
yeah.
most used song. Couldn't I just tell you the way that I feel? You're such an eclectic artist. I wonder where you came from. And I mean that literally and also musically, what your
cabbage leaf, yeah.
Cabbage leaf. I know you're from the Philadelphia area, but I wonder what influences you absorbed on your way to becoming an American-British band called Naz.
Yeah, it's interesting because Philadelphia did have its own music in a way. We had a label called Cameo Parkway, but the artists were like Chubby Checker and Dee Dee Sharp, and all they sang about were dance crazes and things like that. But we did have a station that played a lot of R&B music, and I consider that more the music of my youth than, for instance, typical rock and roll like Elvis Presley. I was never an Elvis Presley fan. I can appreciate what he has accomplished, and I can see the appeal of his early records, but they didn't connect with me. I was fixated on the guitar as an instrument and thought that if I was a musician, that's what I'd like to do, is be a guitar player. So learned to play guitar all through high school, and when I got out, I managed to get into a blues band pretty much within a few weeks of graduating, and did that for about 8 or 9 months. And then acid rock was discovered, and the band decided they wanted to be like the Grateful Dead or something, go to the country, drop a lot of acid, and get their heads together. And so I moved on from that and plundered several of the other local bands to find the musicians that I wanted to play with, and formed a band called the Naz. And we were something of a local phenomenon, but it wasn't too long after we formed, maybe about 6 months, that we got, quote, discovered, end quote, talking to Roger Daltrey in the Holiday Inn bar after a Who show in Philadelphia. And a guy came up to us and said, "You guys look like you're in a band." And we said, "Yeah, we dress that way, and because we are in a band." And he said, "I'm looking for a band to manage." So we auditioned for him, and he decided we were the band he wanted to discover. And for the next 18 months or so, we lived the life of rock stars, except for the fact that our records were not hits or anything like that. We went everywhere in limousines, and we were in all the teeny bopper magazines and things like that. But when our record finally did come out, it was, you know, it came out with a mighty thud. And our first single,
Hello,
Open My
Hello,
Eyes.
Hello, It's Me. And your
well, Open My Eyes was
and
the first single, Hello, yeah. And Hello, It's Me was on the other side. And mm-hmm. and it wasn't until we were had finished our second album, we were already in the process of breaking up as a band, that Hello, It's Me became enough of a radio hit that it was worth us going out and playing just to make some money. So even though I had quit the band, I continued to go out with the band on the occasional gig here and there just because we were going to get paid for it. And then soon enough they found a replacement for me, and that's when I had a period of maybe a couple of months maximum where I was doing nothing, trying to figure out what to do next. But because I had taken on such a hands-on approach to the records that the Naz were making, it occurred to somebody working at the Bearsville organization that I might be a useful talent for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I essentially got hired mostly just to produce and engineer records.
And it sounds like producing and making your own records, playing all the instruments, was almost a reaction to the negative side of being in a band and dealing with other personalities in that way.
In a sense, yeah. I had lost all interest in trying to be democratic.
But did you find, was Utopia a conscious effort to regain that?
The specific purpose of Utopia in my mind was to allow me to be a guitar playing front man in an era when I was writing a lot of the material on the piano. And so my own records were getting very piano-y in a way. And I found it a more flexible instrument to write on. But I also felt that in the process of learning more about the piano and using the piano more as a tool and ultimately playing piano live, that I was losing what I had fought so hard to gain as a guitar player. Mm-hmm. And so I formed Utopia as a way to kind of stay sharp as a player, to do something that was something more of a musical collaboration. Problem with the Naz is that I was becoming a much more prolific songwriter than anyone else in the band. And even though we sort of credited everything to everybody in the uh-huh. band in a way, they were only coming up with the occasional song, and I was just coming up with a lot of music.
Well, and Utopia seemed to really open up a lot of doors sound-wise for you. Good example might be the Icon, in fact.
Well, Utopia became unique in the fact that we would perform a lot of the music before we would record it. And indeed, by the time we got to the second Utopia album, it was all live. Mm-hmm. So we were very much about that live performance aspect of it. We did make some use of the studio tricks and things that we had available to us, but that was a far less emphasis than the actual musicality of what we were doing.
Could we hear a bit of the Icon as a contrast to Hello, It's Me? Quite a contrast. Mm-hmm. Sounds like you dropped Ravel, and I know you like Gilbert and Sullivan. It sounds like you grew up in a family where music was at least a part of the fabric and were exposed to quite a wide range.
Yeah, there was a lot of music in our household, and almost none of it was the contemporary pop music or the sounds of what youth was listening to. Mm-hmm. My dad liked classical music and show tunes. My mom liked to listen to the kind of that sort of Patti Page, slightly post big band singers era, and things like that. We would get taken out every once in a while to see summer stock musicals and things like that. And I developed personal interest in certain artists, like, as you mentioned, Gilbert and Sullivan. I was totally fascinated with. Not only the music, but the lyrics and what they revealed about the era that they were written in. And I had a friend who had an equal appreciation for Gilbert and Sullivan. So together we essentially learned their entire libretto and would, at the drop of a hat, break into a song from Pirates of Penzance or Ilanthe or something like that, just to prove how smart we were.
So you came by your eclecticism and sense of flair, honestly.
Probably. And, of course, the Beatles went through such radical evolutions during their career that by the time I got to making music, I thought that was what a band was supposed to do. You were supposed to be eclectic and experiment with other musical styles. It made what you did more interesting. And when I first started the Naz, we did go to some trouble to make sure that there was a good mix of guitar-oriented things and somewhat balladic things and somewhat orchestral things as well. There was a big orchestral arrangement on one of the songs. And, that kind of stuck with me all through what I was doing. Maybe one of the reasons why when I got to Something Anything, I thought that I needed to make a change in that too many of the songs were sitting in the same sort of genre and same kind of approach, and I thought I was wasting my opportunity to explore other things. Mm-hmm. I tend to do things the opposite way of the way other people write songs. I get musical ideas first, and I elaborate those as much as I can before I get to the point of thinking up melodies and words and stuff to go with them. Mm-hmm. And I think that characterizes my records in a certain way. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it's a good way or a bad way, but for the most part, that's how I write music. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm incapable of writing the other way, but since I do have the tools nowadays to make all of the sounds that I want the end product to have in it, I figure I'll just start working on the end product, and I'll start with the part that I'm sure of. What tempo it is, okay? Then I'll have some idea of, maybe what I'd like the rhythmic bed to be like and then fill that out. I'll probably have some changes, like I'll call this a verse, I'll call this a chorus. With the tools we have, I can sort of move those around, I say, maybe that isn't the chorus, maybe that's the verse, and maybe what I think the verse is the bridge, something like that. There's a huge amount of flexibility nowadays. In terms of offline composition, mm-hmm. in a way, you don't have to be in the studio to be able to get into this process. So it could be said that the evolution of the tools has also evolved the way that I write music. In other words, if I had no sequencers, synthesizer, other way to transcribe the musical ideas, I likely would have to sit down and write the whole song out on a piano or a guitar. But since I don't have to, why should I?
Mm-hmm. Well, you've always been an early adopter of technology. I think you said, I fear no machine or no technology. And you always seem a few years ahead of the curve. That includes making music videos before MTV existed and the CDI, the interactive CD or a cappella, where everything was, through an emulator? Your voice was actually fed into a keyboard?
Yeah, well, it seems also that that also puts me on the next curve when the current curve suddenly has peaked. So I often find that I'm doing something or working with a certain tool or in a certain way, and by the time it has been more widely adopted, I've become interested in something else. And so I'm not there to exploit the newfound interest in this thing. I'm only interested in the next thing, what's about to happen. I guess that's always been an essential part of my musical philosophy, is why should I do the music that somebody else is capable of doing? Well, that's just redundant. I need to make music that only I am likely to make. And even though that may not be the most popular music, I won't be confused with somebody else. Mm-hmm. I will have a musical identity of my own. And through the commercial ups and downs of my career, that's remained kind of a constant. And I may, every once in a while, do something that's purposefully redolent of, say, a prior style. I may try and do something that sounds more or less like a traditional R&B or something like that. But the difference will be in the subject matter of the song or something like that. It won't be the typical, I love you, baby, you're so good to me, or I love you, baby, you're so terrible to me. It'll be an R&B song about personal transformation or something like mm-hmm. that, instead. And that keeps me in my own, in my comfort zone. And my comfort zone is essentially only comfortable if it's not rubbing up against somebody else's.
Mm-hmm. Well, personal transformation, actually, there's a good example of that. From Initiation, 1975, Real Man, terrific song where you seem to be grappling with what it means to become an adult and take responsibility, and phrased very elegantly with terrific music.
Thank you.
me.
It's a real man. Real man. Got to grow up sometime, be a real man. Real man. Some of them slings and arrows, be a real man.
Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net.
Except for them slings and arrows.
Yeah.
It seems like you've grappled with, more than most artists, grappled with your inner life through your music.
That's kind of what I get out of it. It's not that I have disdain for my audience. I just realize that their wishes in terms of where I might go musically are motivated by other things than my desires, and that in the end they don't necessarily want to be pandered to so much as learn something about me that they don't know. And ideally in that process, I'll learn something about themselves. Mm-hmm. And in point of fact, that song, Real Man, it sounds like it's about growing up and is intended to sound like, you know, growing up, but it's not about growing up. It's about growing inward. It's about discovering the parts of yourself that are not your physical body and have nothing to do with your gender. It's more about the realization that life is about becoming. It is not about arriving at anything. That is, it's a constant evolution. And that a lot of people are just looking to learn enough in life to be able to get by. And that they are missing out on this whole other life. You know, the life of the mind or whatever. You know, an internal life in which you strive to understand yourself and strive to transform yourself according to what you find there. You have to be willing to face the things about yourself that are unpleasant and then not simply accept them, do something about them. And that's more the kind of responsibility that I'm talking about, not about like suiting up and going to war or any of the mm-hmm. other things that we associate with manhood.
Yeah, in fact, you spoke out beautifully against that and Swing to the Right and One World and Liz Estrada and staying true to yourself. And as you say, that's kept you going for over four decades. I know that this next little excerpt comes from an album called Healing, which was, I think you've described it as the result of a spiritual quest and around-the-world trip and some hard times in 1980 and just looking inward, as you say. And it's absolutely gorgeous. It feels like an album-length meditation.
Well, you can really get burned out if you take seriously this personal transformation thing. It's not the same as going to the gym and lifting weights, you know, or going on a diet so you can get trim. You're going into some territory that is pretty rarefied. And I got pretty aggressive at it for a while and kind of reached a point of exhaustion. And I had to refound myself and reorganize myself in order to get back on track. And so I kind of got fascinated with the idea of music as a therapeutic aid, that not necessarily that you could play the music to someone who was ill and just the sound waves would heal them. Mm-hmm. But if you had it in mind to kind of get better or evolve or whatever, that the music helped you maintain that frame of mind and help that frame of mind become effective for you. And that was essentially the one half of the record. One half of the record was this experiment in musical therapy, and the other half of the record was a story about, I guess, a metaphorical story about someone who had the power to heal other people. Mm-hmm. And what the ultimate result of that is. And essentially the result is that if you do it for people, they don't do it for themselves. Mm-hmm. And so the power to heal is a very qualified blessing in that sense, and that people will just – they'll use you up, and they won't do any of the work themselves.
Well, it seems like it must have been a cathartic record to make. In fact, I'd like to hear a little of that album-length Meditation Healing Part 2.
Look upon yourself only with compassion. Strip away the shell hiding your perfection. Though your past was full of darkness, now the past is gone, and your life is starting over. It has just begun.
I heard that not too long ago live, and you could have heard a pin drop in the hall during that entire section.
Everyone was asleep.
Really, no, everyone was like almost hypnotized. It was beautiful. It was a remarkable experience. It's almost like ambient music 10 years before people started calling it that.
Yeah, it does have great ambient passages in there, you know, and it's the kind of thing where it's hard to do a little, hard to drop into it and then drop out of it, you know, an excerpt like that, even though it accurately represents what's going on musically. There's other aspects of it as well, and it's meant to be, as you say, almost a continual meditation from that goes over the entire side of the record. Mm-hmm. Of course, we don't have sides anymore, but in those days,
well,
it was still vinyl.
In the era of iTunes downloads and single songs,
yeah.
It strikes me that you came of age at just the right time to be an album artist and to have a broader mm-hmm. canvas for your ideas to stretch out across. You would have been a great hit single 60s artist too. You've got that talent, but you seem to play both really well. But I wonder if you mourn the loss of albums as an entity, as an artistic canvas. Young people don't seem to think that way anymore, and young bands don't seem to think that way anymore.
Well, lifestyle has sort of changed. And I have my own theories about why that changed. I have a whole presentation that I've given on occasion about the history of the music business and how audience habits and proclivities have sort of changed over time. Because in the end, it's the audience that defines the market. You can't force people to buy something they don't want to buy. When the Sony Walkman became a hugely popular item, it changed the way that everyone listened to music at that point, because you were able to take the music out of your house and carry it around with you wherever you went. And so it became a backdrop to your lifestyle. Now the music is sharing your mind with some other activity.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually the integrity of the album breaks down because people are no longer listening to the whole album. And the iTunes store, when that came out, reinforced that because their principal model was the 99-cent song. And the albums, when they sold the albums, they added up all 99 cents. It was more expensive than going to a store and getting the CD. But despite that, you know, the music-consuming audience, which is usually much younger than the population at large because they've got the disposable income to burn on music, they just started to see the world of music as being individual songs and less so longer-form works. You don't even evaluate the quality of the artists anymore. It's just all that song. Is that song hot? Are all the kids listening to that song? Then
is it on Guitar Hero or some Disney Channel thing?
There's also that. There is a new generation of artists who actually have been groomed in a way, in a very old style, almost Hollywood sensibility. The whole new Mickey Mouse Club thing that has produced Christina Aguilera and Britney Spears and Justin Timberlake and all these people, they essentially had built-in audiences by the time they got seriously into their record careers. And regardless of the kind of music that they were making, it was going to get bought.
Yeah, and the thing you're talking about, the whole sitting there at 2 in the morning with your head between the speakers, listening intently, focused on music, seems to be, that's how I grew up. Music is the center of my life, is a tangible thing, and that does seem to be lost. If we go back to 1973 and put our ears back on after Something Anything, the album you came out with was A Wizard, A True Star, which is an album with a capital A. It's not a selection of cuts. In fact, I think you've talked about it as intentionally a jumble of the things simultaneously happening in your brain, trying to capture that effect. And maybe we could hear a little bit of that. If the listeners have said, imagine you just heard Hello, It's Me, and I Saw the Light, and you bought Todd Rundgren's new album and heard this. That decision you must have made to say, I'm not going for the charts. And I've heard you refer to this, maybe lovingly so, as sort of your career suicide moment when you decided I'm going to follow my muse and not my, your manager or your radio programmer, your audience's expectations.
That was a general estimation of what I had done. A lot of reviews kind of took that sort of attitude. It became just as interesting to me to start messing around with the sounds of the instruments and utilizing the studio as if it was an instrument instead of just a mechanism to capture sound. And the whole album was the first that we did in the studio that I had built. So the kind of the album and the studio came together at the same time, and the studio represented a whole kind of liberation in that since we owned it, we could do anything we wanted with it. There was no time clock. We could come in anytime we wanted and stay as long as we wanted. We could plug anything into any other thing if we felt like it without some engineer saying, no, 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 you can't do that. You know, my responsibility if I blew something up. So we tended to do things like that, to just overblow things in a way that a normal studio wouldn't, to do all sorts of other little sonic and experimental things, from an oral standpoint, from a musical standpoint, that might not have occurred to me if I had been laboring under the restrictions that a normal studio environment would have had. You know, only certain hours, only allowed to use the equipment in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And so the record represented liberation on a number of fronts for me. And eventually it turned out to be the foundation of my career. It turned out to be the thing that characterized me and separated me from other artists. And in the process of doing that, I began accruing an audience of my own, an audience that wanted to hear what I was going to come up with next, were interested in the kinds of subjects that I was dealing with. They were actually interested in self-exploration and self-transformation and things like that. As it turns out, they are extraordinarily loyal to the point that, you know, I have an audience that's made up substantially of people who have been listening to the music since Something Anything. That's nearly 40 years. So that is what I consider an accomplishment. not the number of hit records that you have, but that you've been able to build an audience of your own that will essentially go through life with you.
I was going to ask some more questions about that transitional moment, but I think you've answered them already. And as you even sing on the album, if you want the obvious, you'll get the obvious, but you're not interested in making the obvious anymore. And as you said, was it a true star? Well, wasn't that, that was the album that the fans voted for what they wanted to, the album they most wanted to see recreated live. So the album that seemed like a mistake at the time.
In 2009, the online radio show called Rundgren Radio, they polled their listenership and said if Todd would do any album in his career, reproduce it live, which one would you want to hear? And it was overwhelmingly A Wizard, A True Star. So I think that says something about my audience and the point at which they became really more intensely interested in what I was doing. And
it's funny when you hear that.
And also a recognition of what it is that's unique about what I do, that is me, essentially, and not me trying to be somebody else.
You sort of were suddenly given entree to this world of musicians to work with and really were hired as sort of this wunderkind genius in the studio as much as maybe a potential hit artist yourself. You're producing the band and New York Dolls and Grand Funk and, you know, on up to Meatloaf, Bat Out of Hell. That seems like almost like your day job to fund your hobby of your own career on a certain level. Is that a fair
That's certainly the way that I saw it. Mm-hmm. I joined the Grossman organization as an engineer producer and was first set about to kind of like transform some of their older artists into more, help them make a more contemporary sounding record, or simply to help them make a record. In the case of the Stage Fright, you know, since I was employed more or less by a Grossman organization, they didn't have to worry about paying an engineer. You know, they had an engineer on staff, so I wound up doing that. And it was only after I'd done a few records for them that I asked for a budget. They didn't sign me as an artist per se. They had maybe thought that I had retired completely from that, but I continued to write music and wanted to have a some sort of venue to document it. So I asked for a budget, and I made the record, and they were sort of taken aback at its eclecticism and the fact that it had a song that had radio potential on it.
We Gotta Get You a Woman.
That was We Gotta Get You a Woman, which could have been a bigger single if it hadn't come out at the same time as a certain amount of feminist rage was happening. And there was a misinterpretation of the lyrics, and the radio stations were getting bomb threats from militant feminist groups. Don't play that song. Don't play that We Gotta Get You a Woman. We're not things. You know, we have to get you a female person or something. I don't know. There was umbrage about it, a basic misunderstanding. And so the record may have become bigger if that hadn't happened, because some people actually took the threat seriously.
And then Something Anything.
And then Something Anything came out, yeah.
It seems like you fear no artist also. I mean, to be 22 and working with a band who were like holy relics at that point after Big Pink and the Brown album. I don't get the sense you were trembling in awe or fear of this.
No, not necessarily. I knew what I liked and what I was ambivalent about. Mm-hmm. And I always found it sort of unusual that these guys were from Canada, but they insisted on coming off as if they were from Alabama. And when indeed none of them had that, nobody except Levon had a Southern accent, you know, but they're still singing about the Civil War and stuff, you know. So, and also when you start to work with people, you know, you realize that they have human foibles as well. You know, if you never meet them, you can put them on a pedestal. As soon as you meet them, they're soon off the pedestal, and that you know, that adoration you had has to be moderated. And I know I had that experience when I was working with XTC. We had such acrimony at certain points of the process that I was unable to listen to XTC after that. You know, it would just remind me of the acrimony. So, yeah, once you start working with people, they become people. You know, yeah. They're no longer these, you know, icons. And the most remarkable thing about them is their ability to come together and form this unique kind of sound and music with a certain sort of quality about it. And when you witness how that comes together, something of the mystique goes out of that as well. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, you know, in watching the band and what they produced, I thought, God, there's a lot of luck going on here. There's just a lot of happenstance.
Well, you went pretty directly from that to having George Harrison hand Badfinger over to you, and the New York Dolls, you were involved with sort of proto-punk, and then turn around and turn Grand Funk, this lumbering jam band or whatever, into a tight singles band with We're an American Band and Locomotion. And
I suppose that's the irony, is that, and probably the frustration for my own label, was that I was able to make commercial hits for other people. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, obstinately refused to do it for myself. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't my attitude. My attitude was that I had songs that could be singles if somebody wanted to work them hard enough. But all through the 70s and into the 80s, there was this evolution in the business towards market analysis. And so people weren't – it was no longer the old-fashioned process of, this sounds like it could be a hit. Let's try and get somebody to put it on the radio so we can find out if it is. Instead, you would send your music to the Arbitron rating system, to Arbitron. Which I think was down in Atlanta or something at the time. And they would have like a typical – what they considered a typical audience sit there and listen to the music and rate it. And you would get a number back from them, some between 0 and 100 or something like that. And if the number wasn't high enough, well, then the label wasn't going to waste the money to promote it. So it was no longer a question of personal belief in the music. You know, it was all this kind of market analysis. And so it became futile for me to even think in terms of singles.
Well, the most famous production you done, I suppose, is Bat Out of Hell, which nobody saw coming and nobody had any faith in but you, from what everyone from Meatloaf on down has said. And you pulled a rabbit out of your hat and had, what, the fifth biggest selling
fifth
album of all time.
Biggest selling of all time at this point, I don't know. And probably since the age of albums is passed, that's the way it's going to stay.
But I mean, is that era over where, like, is the role of a producer different now than...
Well, not necessarily. You know, there were all those freaking boy bands from Orlando, that this one guy essentially discovered and produced. But in any case, it is still possible to make a manufactured product. All of the songs that are in the top 10 now are really, you know, these very mannered, calculated, production-oriented records.
But what you did was not calculated. I mean, you seem to find the unique strengths of each artist rather than impose your will on them.
It depends on what your priorities are as a producer. Mine was always, you know, you got to have a decent song. It's not worth going to the trouble of trying to turn a sow's ear into a silk purse. If you don't have decent material to start with, it's not going to be a pleasant experience making the record. Mm-hmm. The emphasis on the songs probably came about because I was a songwriter, so I felt qualified to make judgments about other people's material. And a lot of other producers maybe don't have that songwriting experience or the breadth of musical sensibility, and will really just take the gig based on how the band sounds. You know, they'll say, well, the singer sounds like they've got a voice that would work on radio, so we'll do that. We won't fret so much about the fine points of the material. If they've got material, okay, we'll do that. And then often, you know, acts are not looking necessarily to be unique, only successful. And so they will sing whatever material is necessary to do that. And those kinds of acts, they're easy, just too easy to produce. They're too easy to do. And I always felt that for me, the production is also a way for me to expand my own musical horizons. And when I work with someone whose music is perhaps unfamiliar to me from a genre standpoint or something like that, I still would like to have the opportunity of trying to make a record with them so that I can learn more about that music, learn more about their sensibility, what makes them, how do they base their determinations on what is, what works for them and what doesn't work for them. And it's often, you know, has to be, you have to sort of struggle to put yourself in their frame of mind sometimes.
Well, you've had a remarkable career as a, I mean, amazing to have a twin career as a producer and mm-hmm. artist simultaneously, and to evolve from a singer-songwriter to a prog rock hero to one of the great experimenters in almost every new genre and technology. And all the Todd Rundgren fans listening are going, hey, Utopia, hello, Naz, hello.
Yeah.
I feel like we're doing the radio equivalent of that collage we started with. It's just not enough time to do more than scratch the surface, but I think we're running out of time, sadly, so you're going to have to come back to IU, Todd, and
Twist my arm.
Twist your arm. We'll twist your arm. I hope you've enjoyed being here, and I've certainly enjoyed speaking with our guest, Todd Rundgren, on Profiles. Thank you for your time and
thank you,
insight.
Glenn.
And it'd be nice to close with what you chose to close your concert with here in our hall at IU, One World.
The program you just heard was recorded in November of 2010. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.